I don't think Andy Stanley will actually be here. So in case you're an Andy Stanley groupie who follows him from down at North Point in Atlanta, I don't want rumors to get out that Andy Stanley will be here. But it is a book that he wrote and some teachings from him, and Saul knows that. I'm just teasing him. But so he'll be teaching us via video and stuff. It's a good series. I think we've even gave away the best question ever here, so you might already know it. But it's still worth thinking about and talking about for a good long while. We're going to take up offering here. There's this part in 2 Corinthians, one of the letters that Paul wrote to the church there at Corinth, where he's talking about how vital giving is. He's talking about how the gifts that the church gives to other churches, how incredibly important they are, how they keep people fed, how they keep the church alive, how they keep the church running. And then he kind of just drops this little thing. He says, but God loves a cheerful giver. And we hope that comes across when we do this every week, that this is vital. It's important. It's important not just for the church, but for each of our hearts that we give. But we hope that as you give a little like, woohoo, as you put it in there, because it really should be done freely and with joy and in freedom. So we hope that you do that and give a little woohoo in your heart as you do that. If you want to audibly yoo-hoo, that'll be fine for the next few minutes for any reason. All right. So in this series, we're using this thing, Twitter, which is a social network where people go on and they follow people. We're using it as a frame to understand the book of Proverbs. We're doing it for a few reasons. One reason is that a Twitter feed reads a lot like the book of Proverbs. If you're not familiar with Twitter, like I kind of gave an intro at the beginning, but just to remind us, the way it works is that people send out tweets of 140 characters, just their basic thoughts about the world or something funny that happened or what they think about life. And they send that out into the Twitterverse. And if you're on there, then you would send out your thoughts about the universe or what kind of sandwich you had or how cute your cat looks or something like that. And then in addition to that, you would choose people that you want to follow. So you might, if you're under 25, you'd probably follow all your friends because they're all on there. But you might follow celebrities, authors, journalists, all that kind of stuff. You name it, and then it comes out on your Twitter feed, and it's a way to kind of listen in on conversations and also to join conversations. And just in case you haven't seen it, we want you to see a Twitter feed so that as we talk about this, you kind of know what it looks like. So that's Justin Bieber's Twitter feed. In case you wondered what it looks like, that's his page. And that's kind of the way it works, is you just see these tweets kind of go down the page. You may have also heard people talk about hashtags, right, which you may know better as the pound sign. But it's a hashtag is what they call it in the Twitterverse. And all the hashtag is just a way to categorize something. So every time you see a hashtag, you can kind of think to yourself, file this under blank. Like, that's kind of what the hashtag means, is it's a way to categorize things. File this under blank. So for this series, we've started a hashtag on Twitter. It's hashtag God Wisdom. So if you're on Twitter, we'd love for this to kind of catch on for people when they're in the service. You can get your phone out and live tweet stuff. You can maybe through the week send out proverbs, send out things that you're thinking about the world or about life, about faith, whatever, and just use that hashtag God Wisdom, so that at the end of the series, we have this whole sort of thread of things that people have said about the series. So hashtag God Wisdom. Now, this series came about because, like we said, Proverbs reads a lot like tweets. Proverbs are real short. They pack a lot of information into just one sentence. They're not in any particular order or theme, so you could read through a chapter of Proverbs, most of them, and it just kind of goes from one thought to the next, a lot like a Twitter feed. And so as we talk about this sort of new phenomenon, the Twitter thing, we also want to talk about something that's really ancient. So we're going to talk a little bit about the world of the Proverbs first. There's some things for us to know about the world that gave us the Proverbs, about what was going on in Israel when the Proverbs were written. We've been looking at Proverbs for a lot of this year. We had a whole series before Easter about them, and then Pete started us off with this at the end of Easter. Just some things to know. A lot of the Proverbs, they were written under the reign of Solomon. And he is known as a guy who sought wisdom. He wanted to understand the world and God and people, and he wanted there to be order in the world. And so he looks for order in the world. But there's some things to know about the world when the Proverbs are written. I don't know if you know this, but just for the basics, the Old Testament is all about the story of Israel. And for the first half of the Old Testament, for a lot of Israel's history, they are this wandering, small group of nomadic people who don't have a place to call home. They're a puny country. There's not a whole lot of them. So when you hold them up to the other nations of the world, they look very small. Again, a lot of the beginnings of their story, it's kind of like pioneer days. It's almost like when you think about early America and the Oregon Trail, except maybe they didn't get as much dysentery. I don't know. But it's kind of like that. There's just people kind of wandering around looking for a place to settle. And for a lot of Israel's history, and because they're so small in number, and because they don't have a lot of resources, and because they don't really have a home, their dependence on God is very obvious to them. It's very clear that when they survive, and when they make it through another generation, and when they make it to the next place, it's very clear that they are relying on God. Sometimes there are even seasons where every one of their meals literally falls out of the sky. There's a season where every one of their meals is this bread-like stuff called manna that just shows up every day. They don't do anything to earn it. They don't kill anything. They don't grow anything. Just every day, God, right from the hand of God, they get this thing called manna. And it's very clear that Israel's dependence is dependent on God. When they win all those battles that are in the Old Testament, when it talks about them taking down armies, they're taking down armies that are 10 times their size. So everything that they do, it's very clear in their history that God is keeping them alive. By the time that the Proverbs are written, everything's changed about Israel. They have settled down. They have found a home. They have built up a country. They now are kind of a power player in the politics. Solomon's making all these friends with world leaders. And for the people individually, they have, a lot of them have trades now. They're making money. They are building homes. They're building up their families. They no longer have to worry about where all of their meals are going to come from. And because some of them have jobs and all that stuff, there's more competition. So some of them have money and some of them are trying to have money. There's consumerism now. They want the best of things because they can have the best of things now. And the other sort of really important thing about this is that because they have these things, because they're settled, because they're making money, because they have power, their connection to God is a lot less obvious to them. And they can forget sometimes that their survival is dependent on God. They find themselves with a lot more time. They find themselves with a lot more choices. And they find themselves making a lot more mistakes because of that. And the funny thing about this world is that, you know, in the early days of Israel, they might have been afraid a lot, but they were alive. There was a lot of passion going around Israel. But now they're just sort of numb. They're kind of satisfied. They're passionless. They're disillusioned. They're bored. The same world that gives us the Proverbs gives us the book of Ecclesiastes, where the writer says, I feel like I'm just chasing after wind. Everything I'm doing feels empty. I can't get any satisfaction. I'm not sure life has any meaning. So that's kind of how they're all feeling. We have a lot of time, but we have a lot of resources, but we just don't know what to do with ourselves. Now let me just ask you, does that sound familiar at all? Because that world is a lot like our world. They come from a time and a people who are more like us than we think, maybe. See, they have a lot. They don't know what to do with it. They have so many choices that they end up making bad choices. Sometimes they don't make any choice at all. They go from being these people who are fearful but courageous, who are passionate and who have all this stuff, to being people who are just kind of sitting around going, what should we do today? What should we wear to the mall? What do we do with all this extra money and time we have? And that's kind of where they find themselves. And remember, from the first series that we did in this, Proverbs starts with this picture of the people choosing between wisdom and folly, that there are these two voices competing for their attention in the world, and one is wisdom and one is folly. And so just like in our world, we have those voices, right? We have choices about who to listen to. So Solomon, as the leader, he decides that what these numb, kind of privileged, passionless people, what they need is wisdom. It says early on, he says, get wisdom. If it costs everything that you have, get understanding. And so since we're a lot like Israel, and since we struggle too sometimes with just being numb and losing our passion and not being sure what to do with all of our time and all of our choices, and because we also sometimes make mistakes and take wrong turns. And because we also forget that our dependence is on God and our survival rests on God, we're going to go after some wisdom here tonight. And here's what the Proverbs say about wise people. And you're not going to like it, because I don't like it. This is what it says. It says that wise people love being told when they're wrong. Anybody here just really love being told when you're wrong? Anybody just love being corrected and criticized and called out? Just in the two chapters that we're looking at, here are some references to this idea that wise people love being corrected and that wise people listen to other wise people. This is what it says. Proverbs, this is just chapter, this is the very first verse of 12. It says, whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but whoever hates correction is stupid. It says it right there. I don't know if that's, some houses, stupid's like a bad word. You're not supposed to say it. It says it right there. If you hate correction, you're stupid. So check. I'm one of those. All right, this is what it goes on to say this. Now, this is verse 15 to 19. It says, the way of fools seems right to them, but the wise listen to advice. Fools show their annoyance at once, but the prudent overlook an insult. An honest witness tells the truth, but a false witness tells lies. The words of the reckless pierce like swords. Pete kind of talked about that last week, but this is the flip side of that. The tongue of the wise brings healing. Truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue lasts only for a moment. Now, this is what it says in 26. It says, the righteous choose their friends carefully, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Then it goes on in verse 13. This theme comes up a few more times. It says, a wise child heeds a parent's instruction, but a mocker does not respond to rebukes. Where there is strife, there is pride. But wisdom is found in those who take advice. Whoever scorns instruction will pay for it. Not in a good way, in a bad way. You will pay for it if you scorn instruction. But whoever respects a command is rewarded. The teaching of the wise is a fountain of life, turning a person from the snares of death. A wicked messenger falls into trouble, but a trustworthy envoy brings healing. Whoever disregards discipline comes to poverty and shame, but whoever heeds correction is honored. A longing fulfilled is sweet to the soul, but fools detest turning from evil. Walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm. And this may be one of the Proverbs' greatest hits. It may be also misused a lot, depending on your understanding. But this is that famous verse, those who spare the rod hate their children, but those who love them are careful to discipline them. Now, that last one, that might have been written on a paddle used on you, and if so, I'm sorry for the memories. We could have probably a lively debate against corporal punishment, but I think the thing we could all probably agree on is that five-year-olds need to be told no sometimes, right? The general theme of this verse is that children need corrected, and the general theme of all of Proverbs is that we all need corrected. This theme comes up several other times throughout the book of Proverbs. One of the famous ones is from Proverbs 27:6 that says, wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. Another sort of famous one that comes out of the Proverbs is this idea, iron sharpens iron. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. So the Proverbs have a lot to say about discipline and how it's good to be told that you're wrong. And I just want to kind of pause, because when we think about discipline, and this is hashtag discipline, because we're going to use Twitter language, hashtag discipline. When we think about discipline, we think of a lot of different things. Maybe the first thing that you think about is self-discipline, right? That's one thing that we think of is the things we do to train ourselves and to have good habits. And we spent a long time talking about this back in the summer in our Spiritual Life 5S's series, where we talked about how, just like an athlete, we need to train well. So we think of discipline as something we do to prevent trouble. But we also think of discipline as something that happens afterwards, that's reactive, where somebody has done something wrong, and so they get disciplined. So we think of discipline as something that we practice or that we receive. And we may not have good thoughts about it, but here's the picture that Proverbs paint for us. If we will open ourselves up to the correction of trusted sources. That's a really important part. If we will open ourselves up to the correction that comes from trusted sources, we can live wisely. And the Proverbs say this kind of discipline, this kind of thing where we listen to other people, it could change everything about your life. It goes on to specifically say if we'll listen to wisdom, we would choose better spouses. That's what it says. So if you would listen to your wise friends, you would choose better spouses. It says we would eat better. It says we'll work harder, we'll work smarter, we'll deal with our emotions better, we'll have less anxiety, we'll use better words, we'll spend our money better, we'll be better parents. Thing is, we all want all those things, but Proverbs says the way that you live that way is to listen to people who are doing it, to listen to wisdom. If we let trusted sources correct us, our lives will change. If we find ourselves choosing the wrong path, if we find ourselves forgetting our connection to God, or if we find ourselves falling asleep because our own lives bore us, then what we need is correction. What we need is to hear truth spoken to us, and we need to absorb it and embrace it and listen to it. See, this is one of those things that we all kind of get. Like sometimes at church you come, you learn something new. Sometimes you come in and you're like, yeah, I know that. I just don't want to know that. This is the thing we all get. We all get that if you wanted to be better at a sport, if you wanted to be better at your job, if you wanted to be better at some skill, that you would get coaching for that, right? We know that. We know that coaching helps us to improve in things, but that doesn't mean that it's easy for us to receive, right? And there's a lot of reasons why correction is not an easy thing for us to receive. There's a lot of reasons why we don't always want to hear truth. For one, we live in a world where there is so much criticism flying around all the time that it gets kind of hard to know when to pay attention to it. It gets hard to know when you can trust what somebody has to say because everybody's being critical all the time. There's even a word for this. We call people haters, right? Hashtag haters. Haters gonna hate, right? We know that there are people out there who that's just what they do all the time. They hate everything. They criticize everything. One of the tough things about living in a world with Twitter and Facebook and blogs and even emails and phone systems is that it's so easy for everybody. We have a million opinions all day, and we have a million venues to put them out into the world. Somebody said, Facebook, it's basically like going into a Walmart and being able to read everybody's mind. That's what Facebook is. This is kind of how the world works. Now everybody can send out what they think about everything all the time. And then when there's no actual real-life relationship, you will throw a lot of hate out into the world. You will throw a lot of criticism out into the world. And so we get so careless with opinions that basically before long, everybody is kind of hardened to even hearing wisdom because everybody's just so tired of hearing what everybody else says. So what we do is we put up these defenses and we say things like, I'm gonna trust my own voice. I'm gonna trust my own gut. I'm gonna go with my instinct. And we just go with ourselves because we're so tired of hearing it from everybody else. See, in a critical world, that's what we're tempted to do, is to just trust ourselves. The problem is there's so much unhealthy correction in our world that what we do is we end up protecting ourselves and blocking out healthy correction. We build up our defenses. We'll launch preemptive attacks, right? I'll criticize you before you get to me. We do this in our families. We do this in friendships. We do this in churches. We do it in offices. I probably don't even really have to describe this to you very much because you know it. Like, you know what happens to you, even physically, when somebody comes at you with something that you need to change. Just close your eyes and imagine seeing the red lights behind you when you're driving. Right? You know what happens when you see the police pulling up behind you to wisely correct your speeding, right? I don't know if you saw this week. The Dayton Daily News said that tickets given in Dayton have increased 1,400% over the last year. So hashtag be careful because they are coming after you. But we know what happens, right? We tense up, we come up with excuses, we fight back, we get real mad. We know that happens. Imagine just for a moment that your spouse decides to correct the way that you put things back from the dishwasher, right? Just think about what physically happens to you when your housekeeping is corrected. Think about what happens when somebody corrects the way you pronounce a word, right? I mean, don't you just love that, right? I should love it. Think about what happens, right? We tense up. We start to fight back. We come up with all the reasons why we're in the right. The tiniest little corrections in our life can feel like a blitz, like an all-out attack. So we launch into defense. We do whatever we can to kind of avoid that kind of confrontation. A couple weeks ago, our staff went through a horrible thing that maybe you've had to do as well. We had to go through active shooter training, which maybe if you work at a school or something like that, you or in a public place, maybe you've had to go through that. Like imagining what we would do if somebody came in here intending harm with a gun. It's active shooter training, and it's an awful thing to think about, but we know we have to be ready for that. But one of the things that Dick Wilson, our security guy, he told us is, he said that there are basically three options that we have, and then he taught us how to know which of the three things that we're supposed to do. But the three things we're supposed to do if we're under attack are run, fight, and hide. Run, fight, hide. And we, like I said, we talked about what to do and how to know what to do when. And a lot of it kind of sounded like it relied on our instincts, because I've been thinking over this week about this message, and I'm thinking, man, those same impulses are alive in us when somebody brings something to us emotionally. We run, we fight, or we hide. Right? That's what we do. If it's any kind of truth, it doesn't even matter. It might be somebody coming to correct us. It might just be something that we hear from a message, or we read in scripture, or we read it on a Starbucks cup, and we know it's true, and we know that it should be true about our lives, but we go into our defensive mode, and we run from it, or we hide from it, or we fight against it. I got to learn this in a funny way over the last few weeks. We've been working on a project with ACE, which is our partners down in Jamaica. We're excited to do this with them. It's their 25th anniversary this year. And so we're working on this big project to help them tell their story. We want to help them get their story out there so they can reach other churches, so they can build up their support. So I've been working on pulling together ACE's history and kind of gathering all their stories. And I've been meeting with Marla, the director, and we're basically trying to put together, I'm writing, ghostwriting a book for them. And then we're doing a bunch of media that we're going to help them use for promotion. And you'll hear more about it when it gets close to being done. But it was this—it's this great big project that I've been working on. It's this huge learning experience for me, because a part of what I had to do is I had to write this big long document. It's like 60 pages in Word, and then we had to send it off to an editor. And I knew somebody who might be here tonight. I don't know if she is, but somebody in our church who I knew I could trust, who I knew she'd be really good at going through and finding things that weren't right, things that didn't make sense or misplaced commas or whatever. I knew she could red pen it up, right? And I was excited about that. I wanted that to happen. I needed it. But honestly, if I'm going to tell the truth, I really thought it was going to come back with not a lot of errors, right? I'm kind of like a kid in the Christmas story, Ralphie, like when he writes the essay and he thinks that the teacher's going to give him A++++, and then he actually gets like a C- or something, I can't remember. I kind of felt like that because I get it back and it's every single paragraph there was something wrong. Like every single paragraph. And I had to go through for like 2 or 3 days. Each time we went through this process, I had to just sit there for 2 or 3 days and face every one of my mistakes on paper. Like I had to look at it. I had to just sit there with it. I had to correct it. Apparently, I'm just a wicked abuser of the dash. Like I just careless. I had to throw dashes all over the place. I get this back. Every paragraph needs something that's corrected, and it was painful. And I'm sitting there, and every red mark, every misplaced comma, every wrong word, every little thing. Honestly, it could have been worse. That is the truth. It could have been worse. But all the little things, I just felt like they were just jumping up and telling me what a dummy I was. Like all day long, like you're a big dummy. You made the wrong choice. You picked the wrong word. You put the comma in the wrong place. And I just felt like I had sat for days with failure. And eventually, one of these days, I had to just stop and go, this is punctuation. Like get over it. Like why is this bothering you? So much, and I realized it didn't really have anything to do with the work in front of me. It didn't have anything to do with these words or these pages. It was bothering me so much because it had to do with something bigger. Edit my writing, that's fine, I need it. Edit my life? I didn't want that. it felt too much like that thing when somebody comes to you and says, you're off course. Something's not right. And I had this thing. I realized I couldn't handle it. I was covering over this sort of deep fear that someday somebody was going to come into my life and just take this red mark and just scratch it across me and say, you're choosing poorly. You're failing. You're lost. And so every time I saw some misplaced comma, every defense, every fear kind of came to life in this little thing. And I started thinking, what if that's not just me? It might just be me. I might be the only one in the room who feels that way. And if so, I'm sorry for wasting your time, but I'll feel better at the end of this weekend. It might just be me. But I think it might happen a lot. And I think there might be a lot of us who we can't quite get that the common denominator in a lot of our struggles is us. And we won't hear from other people that that's true. And when something little happens, like somebody corrects some little thing, or we get a speeding ticket, or it's because that we have this deep fear that at some point somebody's going to come along in our life and just write us up, just tell us we're choosing poorly. And then I looked, I thought, you know what, maybe this isn't even just about personal stuff. I thought, what about these cultural debates that we're in that nobody can win? What if part of that is because nobody knows how to listen anymore? What if part of that is because nobody will hear the other side? What if the part of that is because every time truth comes up, everybody runs and fights and hides? So I think maybe a lot of us, we're so tired of being corrected in the little things. We're so bad at the little things. It's no wonder that we struggle with the things that matter. Try to imagine someone coming to you and telling you, something in your life has fallen apart, and I don't know if you see it. Try to imagine someone coming to you and telling you, you hurt me. That's hard to take. Proverbs says wise people love that. Even more than loving it, wise people will go after it if they don't have it. Wise people will go to somebody and actively say, will you tell me where I'm off here? Rather than running or fighting or hiding, wise people, when they are confronted with the truth, they will listen, they'll absorb it, and maybe even embrace it. There's a great story in Scripture about this happening. And we tell a lot of stories about David around here in classes all the time because there's something for everybody in the story of David, right? He's got this great underdog story where he fights the giant. He goes on to become a decorated soldier. When he's not winning battles, he's writing hit songs. Like, there's a little bit of something for everybody in the life of David. But on top of all these great things that David does, including becoming a king and all this great stuff, he has this great story of failure in his life. You maybe have heard the story where he sees a woman bathing across the street and he invites her to his home and he sleeps with her even though she's married to somebody else. And this man who's called a man after God's own heart, he has failed miserably. And if that's not bad enough, when it's found out that Bathsheba is pregnant, he has her husband put on the front lines so that he's killed. And he never has to face the consequences of what he's done. His storybook life can just keep on going. Except that he's got this friend. He's got this friend named Nathan who listens to God. He's called a prophet. And Nathan comes to him one day and he says, David, I know we're friends, right? We're friends. We're bros even, right? We're friends. He says, David, I need to tell you this story. Nathan says, David, just imagine that there was this guy who was really rich, and he had everything. He had houses, boats, animals. He had everything. And then there was this other guy who was really poor, and the only thing that this guy had was a lamb whose fleece was white as snow. I just had to say that. He had a lamb whose fleece was white as snow. So there's this rich guy, and there's this poor guy. And the rich guy who has everything takes the poor guy's lamb and cooks it and eats it. What would you think of that story, David? And David says, well, that rich guy's a tool. That's awful. That's an awful story. Who would do that? And Nathan looks at him across the table and he says, you're the rich guy. You're the tool. He says, you are the man, but not in a good way. Not in the you are the man kind of way, in the you're the tool way. And David, who could have run, fought, or hid, repents. He hears the story, he listens to it, he absorbs it, he embraces it. He names a son after Nathan. That's how good their friendship is. See, for as wrong as David is in this season of life, he has one thing going for him. He listens. He listens to the truth, and it makes all the difference. Now, we should note this about Nathan, because this is a really important part of this teaching. It's really important that we understand Nathan is a trusted source. This conversation works because Nathan has credibility. He lives and he walks with wisdom. He is not offering just anonymous criticism. David knows Nathan has his very best interest at heart, and not all critics do. But if someone comes to you and you know that they love you, and you know that they have your best interest at heart, and they tell you, I got a story to tell you, then you need to listen to it. Now, word of caution here, because if I was out there, I'd be going, I cannot wait to go be Nathan to some people. Right? And I would be making the list of the people. I would say, you're the tool. And the Bible told me to tell you that. And Laura told me to tell you this. Hashtag Laura told me to. You need to hear this. And that would be a whole other conversation, because honestly, we do need to be like Nathan sometimes, and we do need to be the people who bring the truth, but that's not what this is about this weekend. Because before we can be Nathan, we need to be David. The point right now is, can you receive correction? When you hear truth, what do you do with it? When you hear something in Scripture, when you hear something from a message or a song, or you read something, what do you do? Now, this doesn't mean that you just conform to everyone's opinion of you, but it does mean that when a trusted source presents you with truth, you listen. What this means is going to the minutest things. If you're in traffic and someone honks at you, what this means is that you check to make sure they're not right before you honk back. In life, what this means is if someone calls you out on something, you check to make sure if they're right before you fight back. If you look around your life and no one is honking at you, if you look around your life and there is nobody who ever corrects you, something ain't right there. If you can't think of a single person who could come to you and tell you the truth, then that's a problem. That means you have not given them permission. And here's the thing. If we don't practice this on each other across tables, if we don't listen to each other, if we don't correct each other, if we don't absorb the truth that comes from our friends, then it will get harder and harder for us to receive the kind of formative shaping that can come from the hand of God. If we have said that we want our lives to look like the life of Jesus, that's going to mean that we open ourselves up to change. That's going to mean that we hold ourselves up next to the description of the life of Jesus, next to the letters of Paul when he describes what a life could look like. That means that we hold our lives up to that and we say, how could I look more like that? It means that when we read the Bible, we're open to hearing, where have we failed? Where are we lost? It means that when we become numb or passionless, when we're just sitting around, just kind of wasting our time, it means that we listen to the Spirit of God to speak to us and to wake us up from that. That's what the Spirit of God is there to do. When we talk about the Holy Spirit, it is there to counsel us and to correct us. In John's gospel, right before basically Easter, when it's getting down to the last days that Jesus is going to be with them, Jesus is trying to assure them, just because I'm not going to be around, it doesn't mean that God won't be with you. And so he tells them, I'm going to leave a spirit behind. There will be a spirit in the room when you're together. And he says that spirit, he calls it a spirit of truth. He says that what the Holy Spirit should do is it should remind us of the things that Jesus said and the things that Jesus did. It counsels us and it corrects us. But the thing is, if we have not learned to listen when our friends talk to us, if we are so used to putting up our defenses that when God talks to us, that's what we'll do. We won't hear. We'll just forget. We'll do stupid things and it'll feel like we can't take them back. We'll never be able to tell the truth to anyone because we've never heard it for ourselves. You want to change the world? You want to go out and get the world to listen to you about how it should be? You got to listen first. Listen to correction. If nobody is offering it to you freely, then go find someone you trust and ask them honestly, where is my life off course? Tell me how my life looks different from the life of Jesus. Here's the funny thing about Twitter, if we can go back to that. Twitter uses the language of following. When you choose somebody that you want to kind of pay attention to, it says that you're following them. And it's the same word that we use to describe what it means to be a Christian, that we're following Jesus. And really, it's a word of submission. It's saying when you follow somebody, you're saying, I want to hear what you have to say about the world. I want to hear what you had for lunch. I want to hear what you have to say about how the world works. It is a word that means we're open to hearing from someone. And a Twitter feed is really just this list of people that we have agreed to listen to. We're saying that when this person speaks, their voice can reach us. Now, I don't care if you're on Twitter or not, but all of us have some kind of metaphorical Twitter feed. Who are the people that you listen to? Who do you let speak to you? Who is shaping the way that you see the world? Who is shaping the way that you see yourself? Who is shaping the way you understand God? And when you hear true things, whether it's through a friend or through scripture or through the thing on your Starbucks cup, when you hear something about how life could be, how do you respond? Do you run, fight, hide? Or do you listen, absorb, and embrace? And if someone looked at your life and they tried to decide who you were following, who would they think it was? We're going to end this with practicing listening right now. We're going to sing a song that we've done together before here. It's based on words that actually came from David. Because he's had this experience with Nathan, he knows that correction can be met with grace. And so because of that, he is open to the correction of God. And he writes these words where he asks God to search me, to test me, to see the truth of me, and then to lead me. And so what we're going to do, you're just going to stay seated, but you're going to sing along with Levi and with Jessica. If you want, I would encourage you to maybe think about your posture. Sometimes we do this in prayer. Sometimes it helps us to open our hands on our lap to say we're ready to hear this. This could be a moment when God sort of tells us some true things. I want you to know just a little snippet. There was a guy who... a lot of us read his books. His name is Brennan Manning. He wrote a great book called Abba's Child. He was a Franciscan priest who his whole life struggled with alcoholism. He couldn't get past it. He couldn't beat it. He just kept struggling. And he wrote all these books about how much God loved him. And he passed away just yesterday, but he lived this life where at the end of it, he wrote this book that was just this giant confession of all of his failings. And he did it because he knew that he could confess, he could tell the truth about those things because God loved him anyway. He knew that the point of correction is so that we can know the grace of God, so that we can put it all out there in the light and let God heal us. He said this, it's my favorite words from him. He said, define yourself as one beloved by God. Every other identity is an illusion. He said that knowing that his life wasn't what it's supposed to be. He said that open to the correction that might come from following after Jesus. So let's just listen. Again, this is a prayer. Sing along with it. Open your hands. Do whatever you can. So just let this song be your words to God for a little while.